And you may reserve some time for rebuttal.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Amber Hardwick, Councilor Marks-Kuo, Ken Yalowitz, you've already heard from. May it please the Court, this appeal is about whether the trial court erred by denying Marks-Kuo's attorney's fees under RCW 484.330 or abused its discretion by denying Marks-Kuo's motion for terms under CR 11 and CR 26G. With our time today, I'd like to address assignment of error number one, which is the whether Marks-Kuo is entitled to attorney's fees, where respondents' tort claims place the contract centrally at issue.
I have a threshold question that none of the parties seem to address. My understanding is that you are seeking to enforce a contractual provision for attorney's fees, right?
That's correct, sir, Your Honor.
And you're seeking to enforce these fees against an entity that is not a party to the contract.
That's correct.
What authority is there to do that?
Your Honor, in Deepwater Brewing, it involved the enforcement of an attorney's fees provision in an easement agreement against a non-signatory homeowners association. In that case, the determining factor, it was an RCW 484.330 case, and the determining factor was whether the claims were on the contract because the court could not decide the claims without reference to the easement agreement.
Was the entity there a successor in interest to either side of the property involved with the easement?
The claimant was a successor in interest to the dominant easement holder.
Other than the easement case, do you have any authority for attempting to enforce a contractual provision for attorney's fees against someone who's not a party to the contract?
Your Honor, we do have equitable basis under...
Not equitable. There are three bases for attorney's fees: contract, recognized ground of equity, and statute. You're relying solely on the contractual provision, right?
We're relying on both the basis in equity for equitable estoppel and the basis on the contract.
Okay, so explain to me whether or not you have any authority other than Deepwater for the proposition that you can enforce a contractual provision for fees against someone not a party to the contract.
Deepwater is the only case that is directly on point to the attorney's fees provision against a non-signatory. However, in all of the cases cited by Marks-Kuo in our brief, the determining factor was whether the contract had to be referenced to prove the claims, whether they be tort claims or not. In this case, respondents have put the contract centrally at issue because they've alleged that Marks-Kuo failed to properly investigate the conditions at the project and disclose those conditions to them. They concede that Marks-Kuo prepared its investigation and its reports as part of the agreement, but don't want to address any of the limitations in that agreement. Both the scope of the investigation and the obligation to disclose were created under and defined by the agreement. And this court held in Edmonds v. John L. Scott that when tort claims for duties are created under and defined by a written contract, it places that contract central to the dispute. And as we discussed, the contract is the only place that identifies that Marks-Kuo offered to prepare an intrusive investigation and that additional service was declined. The contract also constitutes the circumstances giving rise to Marks-Kuo services. In Affiliated, Supreme Court recently stated, a duty of care is necessarily limited to the level of care that is reasonable in the particular circumstances. There's no dispute that Marks-Kuo's contract constitutes the circumstances under which they performed, and respondents have repeatedly referenced the contract in its briefing to support the purpose of Marks-Kuo's preparing their reports. For these reasons, we believe that the first basis, the wording on the contract, is reasonable under the circumstances because respondents' tort claims cannot be decided without reference to the contract. Your Honor, the second basis is a principle in equity. It's a recognized exception to the general rule that a party is not bound to a contract they did not sign. In Townsend, the Supreme Court recently affirmed this court's enforcement of an arbitration provision against a non-signatory on equitable grounds. And there, they said, equitable estoppel precludes a party from claiming the benefits of a contract while simultaneously attempting to avoid the burdens that contract imposes. Respondents have knowingly exploited the terms of the contract, both on appeal and at the trial court level. They've referenced the architect and engineering standards of care that are only found in Mark Scubo's contract with Evans Development. Well, excuse me, the engineering standard of care are only found in Mark Scubo's contract with Evans Development. And when pressed at the trial court level, they resorted to the contractual standard of care, calling it Mark Scubo's warranty that they would not be negligent. Respondents now contend that Mark Scubo is taking this out of context, but the defendant in Townsend said the exact same contention. They said the breach of warranty allegation was misconstrued, non-signatories had no intention of enforcing contractual warranties, and the Supreme Court was not persuaded. There they held the non-signatories to knowingly exploiting the terms of the contract and being bound by the burdens of the contract. Respondents resorted to these terms of the contract in their linked appeal and at the trial court level, and for these reasons, they should be equitably stopped from avoiding the terms of that contract, the attorney's fees provision before this court. Mark Scubo respectfully requests that this court reverse the trial court's denial of its attorney's fees and terms and remand for a determination of the costs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After the Supreme Court entered its opinions in East Harbor and affiliate is when we first filed claims against Mark Scubo, and that was the adoption of the independent duty doctrine, or the shift in the analytical thinking with regard to bringing a negligence claim for purely economic loss. We made several claims against several defendants in the underlying case and in our complaint. The claims against Scubo were limited to claims for negligence and negligent misrepresentation. Other claims that were made against other parties were not alleged against Scubo. They were kept separate. And claims that were made against Scubo were not made against other parties. For example, there was a breach of contract claim, and that was made against Madera West LLC, the seller of the project.
What's the source of the duty that you seek to impose in this case?
The other side
says you're looking to the contract to establish a standard of care.
I think that's absolutely wrong. I think that we are looking at the product that was provided to the association, which is the reserve study, which said that they could rely on it to show that there is a duty outside of the contract, independent of the contract, which would sustain a negligence claim against Scubo.
You'd agree, but for the contract, there'd be no study.
Yes, that's true. But we didn't rely on that contract in any way whatsoever to make our claims, nor did we knowingly exploit the contract. The only reason that we addressed the contract in the briefing is because they moved for summary judgment on it. We said, but if there is...
You'd found this report just lying on a table in the library. Didn't know where it came from except for what it said inside of it. And then you distributed it to folks. Do you think you've created a duty by the author to the folks you distributed it to without any context beyond that?
Not if I didn't fall within a specified group of persons which that report was directed at. For example, in this case, the association. Would anyone in the public who picked up a book be able to say, oh, yeah, this applies to me and you owe me a duty? No. If that book said this book is prepared for Adel Siddiqui and he can rely on it in the future, then yes, I would think so, Your Honor.
So all those self-help books that are in the library are creating liability for folks that they maybe aren't aware of.
I don't believe so. Maybe the ones for dummies for self-help, I can argue by me, but no, Your Honor. I think what we have here is a specific group of people, and we're not trying to say that Scubo owes a duty to the public, which was talked about, for example, in Berg with those statutes. What we're saying is that you have created a relationship here because you have induced that reliance by saying that the prospective purchaser, that the owners association, could indeed rely on your report. if you look at our motion, it started out by saying we don't believe that Mark Tsukuba's contract with AF Evans has anything to do with us. But after that, the paragraph that Okubo relies on in saying we exploited their contract simply says this, that if the trial court finds that we are somehow bound to that contract between Evans and Okubo, even that contract carves out the risk for negligence and does not allocate any liability amongst the parties for a negligence claim, that Okubo would remain liable if it breached its professional duty of care.
Let me clarify that. Was Okubo trying to use the contract to show a limitation of liability?
Yes. That was their Okubo argued because of its contract with Evans that it had no responsibility to us. That's what I was trying to touch on briefly with them not discussing or addressing the adequacy of the reports and simply saying in defense, you have no right against us because our liability is limited only to Evans, and we have allocated all of the risk therein. And, for example, like a Bershauer Phillips case where you have two private parties where the risk has been allocated amongst the parties already, and therefore there was no recovery for economic loss in that case. Beyond that, Okubo's discovery answers were really designed to solicit answers for interrogatories and deposition questions were designed to solicit answers they wanted for what they thought the association's claim was. But we were very transparent about what the claim was. It was always about the study and the reliance on the dues. It had nothing to do with specific page in the report saying one thing or another when it came to homeowners responding to discovery. We couldn't ask them after 5 years to tell us a specific sentence in over 300 pages that they remember sitting down with the seller at that time. What we asked them to do was identify whether or not they remember the communications to them about the amount of dues that they'd be paying for the project, which is a huge, huge thing for a condominium purchaser. I don't know if any of you have ever purchased a condominium, but in addition to your mortgage every month, you have to pay that dues amount. You don't ever see it, and you don't get it back. And if you get assessed, you won't ever see that money again, and you are going to end up paying for it, and it causes a lot of foreclosures. And reserve studies in the state have now been adopted and designed to help curtail that problem because it's become such an issue, especially with conversions. But the questions that they asked were confusing in and of itself because under the Washington Condominium Act, to take over a unit, you need to close on it. You have to have an ownership interest in it. At the time of purchase, these owners sat down with a real estate agent. He flipped through a 300-page public offering statement and said, here, sign here, sign here, sign here. Here's what your dues are going to be. Sign here, sign here, sign here. That's the time of purchase. So that's the first time they even saw the public offering statement or any of the information attached to it. Okubo said, Do you remember reviewing anything specific in this document at the time of purchase? That's a totally different question than, do you remember going through this document ever before you closed on your house, which could occur 2 or 3 weeks down the road, depending on financing and so on and so forth. But beyond that, none of the owners ever lied to Okubo. They may have been confused about an interrogatory question. They may have misunderstood what they were being asked, but they never knowingly provided any sort of false testimony. We're not trying to skew the fact-finding or truth process here, Your Honor, but the reality is that in every case, if you issue interrogatories and you take those interrogatories through deposition, you may get more information than you originally got in your answer, and you sometimes may have to change an answer based on the context you provide to the deponent. And that's really what happened here if you look at the record. And the trial court got it right, and it didn't abuse its discretion in denying sanctions and fees to Okubo in this instance. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. We have a few minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honors. Unless you have any questions, I'd like to just focus on the terms that respondents have brought up. Respondents asserted claims against Mark Tsukuba as 58 independent individual, or, you know, individual homeowners and as an HOA. In order to manage this, Mark Tsukuba issued targeted discovery requests and got responses, and based their depositions on those responses. For example, 9 out of the 58 claimants admitted in their discovery responses they did not receive or purchase their units in reliance on any false information.
Is there a fact-finding component to the trial court's determination that sanctions shouldn't be imposed?
Yes, Your Honor, to the extent that they have to determine that there was a false statement.
If there are two ways to look at the answers to the questions asked, one that supports your argument and one that supports the other side's argument, why wouldn't that be within the discretion of the trial court, beyond the scope of anything we should meddle in?
I think that if that were the case, that would be reasonable. However, several of the claimants clearly said, well, that was a misstatement. I did not receive this document. The document I was referring to was a different reserve study. And if basically respondents say that if Mark Tsukuba had asked the right question in deposition, they would have gotten the right answer. And this is an adversarial system, but when Mark Tsukuba's counsel asked the claimants if there were any false statements that they relied on, they should have gotten the answer that the false statement is the amount of reserves due. And throughout these depositions, the 9 claimants that we sought terms for on CR-26G, not one of them brought that up.
Brought what up, excuse me?
Brought up the reserve amounts, their reliance on reserve amounts. Mm. And so basically the discovery requests identified, did you receive the reports? Do you contend there are any false statements? And those people who said yes, we deposed them. And then in their deposition, they said, no false statements. I can't think of any. For these reasons, CR-26 is a mandatory sanctions when there is a false statement. And so while there are some of the issues where it's
a statement you later discover is not right and correct it, there's a mandatory obligation on the court to impose a sanction.
It's not mandatory, but in Clips v. State, that's exactly what happened. If there's a false statement and they certified to the contrary and the claimant or, you know, defendant incurred damages, it is mandatory. That's what the certification is there for. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. That concludes our docket for today. The court will be at recess.
Thank you.